Welcome to Betting 360, your number one source for horse racing and sports betting insights. Coming around the bend is your host, David Duffield, with another expert interview to give you the winning edge.
Hello and welcome to Betting 360. I'm your host, David Duffield, and every week here I bring on a special guest to look at punting from all angles. Many people think the life of a professional gambler has plenty of glitz and glamour and basically no losing runs, but the reality is almost always very different to that. So today on the podcast, I have a special guest with a pretty fascinating background. He's a professional gambler, a lecturer, he manages a syndicate for a tennis betting model, and he's the co-author of a great book called Conquering Risk, Attacking Vegas and Wall Street, and his name is Elihu Foystel. Welcome back to the show, listeners. I'd like to welcome our special guest, Elihu Foystel. Thanks for your time today, Elihu, in helping educate the punters from down under.
Good morning.
Morning to you too. Now, many of my listeners will be familiar with your background. I wrote an article recently which covered your thoughts on developing sports betting models and in particular tennis betting. But just in case they missed that, can you give us a quick overview of who you are and what you do?
I used to be a lawyer, and now I'm a full-time sports bettor. I analyze data, study sports, and come up with, you know, mainly quantitative ways to beat sports. I don't put much emphasis on subjective or information. It's all data.
All right. And so how do you even get started doing that? So obviously you need access to the data, but what type of theories or how are you actually coming up with, you know, edges on the market?
Well, you have to understand the sport. And, you know, if you understand the sport, you can describe what you think will happen in terms of math. If you understand it, you can translate that understanding into mathematical equations and then get lots of data. You analyze sports, make predictions, and if you do a better job than the bookmaker, you can bet openers, and if you do a better job than the world, you can bet closers.
Okay. And I've heard you discuss that before and use that as a way of assessing your edge on the market is whether you're beating the closing line.
Yes.
All right. So today I wanted to discuss being a full-time gambler. The question of should I quit my day job and go pro is a fairly wide-ranging topic. So what do you think are the most important things to look at when someone is considering taking that big step?
Well, the very first thing is, are you good enough to do it? Lots of people may try it without the sufficient skills to do it. A newer sports bettor might find a couple of ways he can win and say he makes, you know, $50,000 his first couple of years. But that doesn't mean he's going to keep winning. So it's important to have a skill set where you can win in a variety of ways. And pretty much every successful sports bettor I know has a background in some other type of gambling. So either, you know, mostly blackjack, some in poker. But, you know, once you learn the basics from that, that gives you, like, the skill set to know what you can beat. Because if you can't beat blackjack or if you don't have the math skills to beat blackjack or poker, there's no way you're going to win at sports betting. So you need to have not just one or two tricks, but to have success at pretty much everything you attack. So, you know, it's one thing to beat bonuses. It's another thing to beat convert, you know, just like teasers or something. But you need to be able to take something new and beat it. So if you can beat all the easy stuff and you can beat a couple new markets and you've been able to do this for a couple of years, you probably have the skills to do it. But if all you can do is pick off the low-hanging fruit, I don't think you're good enough because that may not be there. You know, one key thing about sports betting is opportunities are always drying up. Whatever you can win at today, you probably won't be able to win at a couple of years from now. So you need to have, I mean, not only a good barrage of stuff to attack, but you need to have tools to develop new things to attack.
So when people are looking at, you know, the last few years of data and you say that the opportunities dry up, how do you, I suppose, why does that happen and how do you measure that edge disappearing?
When more people start doing the same thing, then you're competing with those same people for the same piece of the pie. You know, an example would be NFL teasers. You know, NFL teasers used to be very beatable. You used to be able to bet two teams 6-point teasers at plus 100. Everyone started doing it, and then, you know, the price to play these teasers dried up, and, you know, they're pretty much gone now. So that's an example of an opportunity that existed that disappeared. 10 years ago, you could in arena football, you could bet every single dog blindly and hit 56%. But then other people started studying it, and they saw that, oh, there's an edge here. And a lot of people saw that edge, and as more people started betting that edge, the books were educated, and that edge disappeared. So over time, the books figure out things, and anything you're doing will eventually either be figured out by the book or other bettors. Now, it's okay if you're, you know, there's some instances of opportunities that'll last, like betting openers, but you're still going to be competing against other sports bettors for those openers. And as more and more smart people learn what it is that you figured out to beat these openers, the amount you'll be able to eat of the openers gets smaller and smaller as it becomes a race to bet those openers.
And do you think that the obsolescence or the edge disappearing is happening quicker and quicker these days?
Yes, because more and more information is coming around. It's easier to get the data you need on the internet. You know, the methods used to analyze things are becoming more well known. So, you know, there's better information, better understanding of what you have to do with the information. So you're going to find your edges disappearing faster than you have in the years past. So you always have to be working on something new.
All right. I've heard you say that you're an applied mathematician and, you know, use math or die. How does someone acquire those skills? Like if, you know, maybe they don't have a strong educational background in terms of maths. How do you suggest other gamblers improve their skills in those areas?
Well, the minimum level of math you have to do to even gamble on any level, you have to understand algebra and percentages. You know, if you walk into a bar and you ask 20 people, what is 2% of 200? 9 in 10 Americans can't answer that, which is kind of scary to me. But that, you know, because that's the minimum level of competence you have to do to even play blackjack, is to be able to take percentages. And, you know, you don't have to be a rocket scientist. You don't have to be able to do differential equations in your head or advanced probability. But, you know, eventually you're going to end up learning that if you try to do modeling. So I'd say, I mean, if you don't have algebra, you need to learn algebra or not bother not try any type of gambling. Right. If you're not willing to learn algebra, save your money, put it in the bank, or just throw it away because it's just the same thing as trying to gamble without knowing algebra.
All right. So in terms of being, you know, good enough, I suppose, is the first step if you're serious about wanting to do it full time. What's a realistic return? I mean, I think many everyday punters, we would call them, believe that, you know, the professionals are operating on pretty fat margins, and it's relatively straightforward that they've got a big edge working for them. The reality is often different, and I think you've mentioned before, say with your tennis betting model, there's huge volume, but it's, you know, 1.5, 2% return. How does that factor into working out if you're good enough? Like, what do you think is a reasonable edge, or does it really come down to, you know, volume's just as important? You know, how many bets you can get on and how many dollars you can get down?
Well, you just said it, you know, what's your edge and how much you're getting down. You know, if you're going to hold 2% of a million or 20% of 100,000, you're still making the same amount of money. So it's it depends on what you're attacking. The smaller markets are much easier to beat. You'll have if no one's heard of the sport or if no one around you knows the rules of the sport, that's probably easier to beat than someone talks about. So if your bankroll is smaller, say you're dealing with under 100,000, it makes sense to attack these smaller sports because you will not have to do as much work and research to defeat it. But if you want to bet on, you know, English Premier Soccer, and, you know, an hour before, where, you know, some of these books are taking, you know, $250,000 in a single pop, you're going to need a lot more resources, obviously, to try to bet that successfully.
All right. What about, I suppose, another important part of deciding if you've got the skills and also the resources to go pro, the size of your bankroll? How do you calculate whether you've got enough money behind you?
And that's a complex question. First, you have to say, you know, how much am I making a year? And you need to compare it to how much you're making, you know, with your day job. So say you're in your sports betting, you've made $30,000 a year for the last 2 years, but you're making $50,000 working a regular job. You know, you're probably not ready to quit your job yet. I would never consider quitting a real job until you look at the time you're spending at the job and say, you know, if I weren't working a job, I'd spend more time betting on sports and I would make more by quitting that job than I would, you know, continuing to work. So, you know, a big step before you quit and walk away from your job is there's going to be a period in your life where you're working a full-time job and you're working a second job, you know, 20 to 40 hours a week on your sport. Now, when you get to the point where, let's see, if you have enough to lose, have a losing year and still pay all your bills and still have enough to bet, then that's probably enough. So, again, that depends on how much money you're making. So, for example, if you're making $50,000, say you have a break-even year, and you're going to spend $50,000. and you need 100,000 at least to bet, then you probably better have at least 150,000 before you walk out of your job. So it's, you got to be real careful when you walk away from your job, because, you know, things go wrong a lot faster if you don't have steady income.
All right. And in terms of the bankroll management, I've heard you say that anyone that overestimates or exaggerates their edge, at least by a factor of two, is almost certain to go bust. Can you just expand on that? Because I think a lot of people would be surprised that a winning player can go bust.
Yeah, it's, well, I'm trying to think of the best way to describe this. Pretend, you know, we're going to play a game, and we're going to flip a coin. And if you win the coin flip, I pay you three times, you know, I pay you double what you bet. So you either lose a dollar or you win $2. So it's a huge advantage. You know, if you, on average, you win two and you lose one, you know, every two flips, you're up a buck. So it's like a 50% edge. I hope I'm doing this right, because I'm doing it quickly. But if I say, now, the obvious example is, I say you have to bet 100% of your bankroll on every flip. If you have to bet 100% of your bankroll, then at some point you're going to lose a flip and you're going to lose everything. But what if I say you have to bet 90% of your money? If you win a flip, you triple your money. Now you lose a flip and you lose 90% of that 300%. So you're down to 27% of your bankroll. So, you know, there's a scale. The closer you bet to your optimal amount, the fastest you'll grow. And on a even money game with a 50% edge, you want to bet pretty close to 50% of your money. It's much easier to do the advantages when you're talking small. You know, like if you're talking a 1% edge, even money, yeah, you risk 1%. The math gets kind of funny when you hit the extremes or when you hit different odds. But if you bet too little, you don't make enough money. And if on a 1% edge, you're betting 3% of your bankroll, there's a 100% chance you're going to lose all your money. It's just a matter of time. So you got to have, you really need to pay attention to what your edge is. Because it doesn't, I mean, you know, betting 2% of your bankroll with an edge, that'll bust you. So you have to spend a lot of time to say, you know, just how good is this advantage?
Yeah, and that's key. If you don't know that, then you're going to, like you said, if you're not anywhere near your optimum bet, you're either wasting opportunities or otherwise heading towards going bust.
Yeah, and the other thing is, if you're betting real money, if you don't know what your edge is, you probably don't have one.
All right, so just to discuss, you know, bankroll management, losing runs, how do you identify what's expected in terms of variance, and, you know, what I suppose has to happen at some stage, and what's actually your edge disappearing? Because I know you have quantitative models, so you don't probably want to be tinkering with those when all that's happening is just a, you know, normal period of drawdown.
Well, it's one metric is to see how much you're beating the closing line. So if I'm, you know, if my average price is pick, you know, even money, and the average closer is minus 120, you know, that represents like a, you know, let's say minus 125. Yeah, sorry, so it's like about a 5% move, and that's a fantastic result. You know, you're seeing 20-25% move, 20 or 25 cent move. But then over time, that'll probably decrease as the market becomes more efficient. Now, one thing you can do when you're tweaking, you say, if I make this adjustment, how have I done in the past? And if I suddenly see that this adjustment has increased my average closing from 5% to 6%, that's just backtesting. That's a good adjustment. But, you know, if I'm losing, and I've gone on some horrendous losing streaks, the first thing you do is say, am I still smarter than the market? And if I, you know, if I drop 20 units, but I'm still beating the market, you know, I'm not in huge distress. It's, you know, the laws of large numbers are going to win out for me eventually, as long as you, obviously, you're not betting too much.
Okay. And so in developing the models that you obviously live by, how do you determine the difference between research and analysis and what we might call backfitting, I suppose, you know, getting results that fit historical patterns that, you know, may not continue to occur in the future?
Make it simple. The simpler the model, or the simpler the approach you're looking at, the less likely it is to be backfitted. You know, if you're going to look at 15 games and you make a degree 15 equation, you can fit it perfectly. If you look at 1,000 games and you're looking at just one component of it with one variable, the risk of backfitting is much less.
So the greater the rules, the greater the chance that it's, yeah, backfitted in some way and less likely to continue in that way?
The more complex your solution, the more likely it is to be backfitted.
Because I know you spent some time developing a college basketball model, but threw it out because you weren't convinced that it would work well enough to actually bet. Why were you certain that it wasn't worth persevering with?
Well, it actually worked several years ago, but I think the market caught up. And then when I was thinking about betting it this year, I back-tested for the last couple of years, and actually the results were not positive. So I was like, oh, well, if I use this approach and I duplicate what happened the last 2 years, I've lost money. So I think I'll just not do that.
Fair enough. So back to the question of going pro. So if they've determined with a lot of confidence that they've got an edge on the market and they've got a bankroll big enough to, I suppose, support their lifestyle, what about the social aspect of being a pro? It's not not all the glitz and glamour. You know, sometimes it really does affect social life. So might just want to expand on that for the listeners.
Well, remember, you at one point you're working a job and you have contact with the same people every day. And suddenly you take that component out of your life. So, you know, half the people you know in life are those people that you work with. So, but when you go pro, you're not just changing jobs. You're probably changing to working in your home. So all the time you're spending now where you used to have contact with other people, you no longer do that. So your world becomes a lot smaller. So you have to make a conscious effort to get out more, to meet people. So your world becomes much, much smaller once you go pro and you're not working for someone else. So it's if you aren't prepared for that, it's a big, big change.
Definitely. And so just to finish up then, so what would you see as the most common mistakes of losing gamblers? I mean, you mentioned the math behind it all and the fact that it's very simple. I mean, surprisingly simple for them to just wipe out completely. But what do you see as the biggest mistake that the everyday gambler makes?
Well, the everyday gambler doesn't use heavy math. You know, they bet on hunches. They bet on a team they like. You know, but they're not serious about winning. If you're not working 40 hours a week, you're probably not doing the work it's going to take to keep winning going forward. So it really is a full-time job. I mean, I probably spend 60, 70 hours a week now. So, you have to look at it as, it's a problem. It's a problem and there's solutions to the problem. And if you're not looking for the answers, looking for the big picture, you know, all the things that affect a game, you know, if you're not studying the data, if you're not analyzing it, you know, treating it as a job, I don't think you can win. At least not enough to support yourself.
Right, and you mentioned 60 to 70 hours a week. Am I right in saying that you don't even watch the games? It's all about the data?
I don't watch most of the games. I'll watch some games if I'm betting them in-game. But other than that, I don't watch any of it. Now, the next thing about in-game, like in-game soccer, some of the market size on some of these things are growing, you know, huge, where it's actually getting easier to bet some stuff in-game than it is pre-game. So, you know, if you're looking forward to the next year, one thing you may look at is attacking in-game markets or, you know, placing more emphasis on that than the pre-game markets.
It's slightly unfortunate here in Australia that we've got this ridiculous law that says you can't bet online in-game. So although we're a bit more developed than the US for corporate bookmakers and the like and just general gambling, they have this law that says you can phone up to have a bet during the game, but you can't actually do it online. So that's pretty restrictive and pretty unfortunate. And the political climate that we're in at the moment, I don't think it's going to change anytime soon.
Well, the US has at least as many ridiculous laws. Like, first, they don't want you to bet. I forget if it was the FBI or Department of Homeland Security saying it's illegal to place a bet on the internet. And suggesting it's against federal law, but there's no law against it, but they still, you know, propose that. And I mean, the whole duel between the U.S. government and sports betting, it's more of a money grab than the application of justice. So it's very frustrating if you start betting at a real level, having to, you know, it's made me consider moving abroad just because of the way the U.S. treats sports bettors.
Oh, well, I won't complain too much then that we struggle with the in-game. It's just in general terms, it is much easier to get your bets on. So we'll leave it for today, Elihu. I really appreciate you giving up your time, and I'm sure all the listeners have learned a lot. So thanks again.
All right, you have a good one. Thanks.
Thanks for tuning in to Betting 360. Get more in-depth analysis, tips, and that betting edge by heading over to championpicks.com.au. where you'll find a full transcript of this episode. If you like the show, share us with a fellow punter or drop by iTunes to leave us your thoughts. Betting 360, punting from all angles.